I have the retiree that shovels for me, so I'm very lucky. And I sent my grandkids out to clean off my car. I can't complain at all.
We could have made a bunch of money, Madam Chairman, with the cars driving down the highway with snow still on the top of them. Wow. I counted 34 coming in.
I don't think mine was that clear either. Okay. Well, welcome. It looks like we hit upon a very interesting topic with the pest control, and we're going to have a presentation on that. But first, we're going to start with the exempting municipal health insurance from the state-mandated premium tax, which was part of the governor's budget when he presented before the legislature. And Betsy Guerra from COST is going to give us a presentation on that, as well as John Elsesser, who's the town manager for the town of Coventry.
All right, thank you. This is actually a very straightforward issue. It's been a longstanding recommendation of COST and both CCM to eliminate the tax on municipal health insurance premiums. So we were thrilled that the governor had actually recommended this as part of his budget, because that's always been a holdup relative to passage of this particular issue. It has been introduced in the past by legislators from both sides of the aisle, so I think it's a really good issue for this particular committee to look at. Certainly, because of the cost of health insurance, people are struggling to find ways to lower those costs, and it's been very difficult. It's put a lot of pressure on our towns. Reducing or eliminating the municipal health insurance premium tax will save 1.75% for those towns that are not self-insured. So this is particularly a big issue for small towns who can't afford to self-insure and avoid the health insurance premium tax. It will also help boards of education that are not self-insured also, so save some money. So some of those funds can be directed into educational programs. I have included in the handout that I prepared a list of many of the towns that will benefit from the elimination of this tax. And again, this is just a partial list. I understand that there are additional towns and boards of education that will also benefit. And I know John has had some, had testified on this issue before, may want to comment on this as well.
Sure. Thank you very much for the time to discuss this very important issue for towns, regardless of the size, but particularly the small towns. I think many of you know that the medical inflation has been going up 10 to 15%. So this 1.75% tax also has been going up by that amount. The original purpose of the premium loading tax was to pay the administrative expenses of the Department of Insurance. So I think as health insurance premiums have gone up, they have not been adding staff or expenses. So it's just become an extra revenue for the state. For towns, we view this as a sales tax. And it's just kind of bizarre that, you know, we're exempt from all other sales tax, but we have to pay this premium loading tax. The state has made adjustments over the year. Obviously, the state doesn't pay this tax themselves, but they have also exempted many other nonprofits and hospitals. So what we're really looking for is equity. We're partners in government with the state of Connecticut, and we feel we should be treated the same. And this amount, as a percentage, doesn't sound huge, but in operating budgets, it really is. When you look at the town of Coventry's operating budget, health insurance as a percentage of our total budget right now is 15% of our spending. When I started there, it was about 7%. So it's doubled, and that means money that can't be spent on road salt, since it's the topic of the day, and has to go to pay money to a portion of it is just going to the State Department of Insurance. Even towns that are self-insured often buy stop-loss protection for the large claims. So even the larger cities and the towns that have had the luxury of being a large enough risk to self-insure will save on this, because anyone prudent will buy a stop-loss protection policy, usually, you know, $200,000, $250,000 per claim. So it's not just a benefit to small, fully insured plans. So we very much appreciate the governor proposing this, and we do view this as a mandate on towns to pay this tax, and would appreciate your subcommittee making this as one of your recommendations to bring equity to the system, and also to help towns and boards of education use the very scarce property taxes for productive uses. Thank you. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And I will open it up to any questions from members of the committee. Yes, Mr. McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is not a question, but an affirmation of what John just said. When this first came out several weeks ago, I frankly said had never heard of this, but I did some digging and found that even though we are a self-insured town, we're a medium-sized town, but we're self-insured, yes, we have that stop-loss or catastrophic insurance, and yes, we have been paying this tax on that portion. So this reaches a lot further than just the small towns who are not self-insured. I dare say it covers virtually any other town or city in the state. So this will be a broad reaching rollback for just about everybody. Thank you.
Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to echo what Fillmore just said. In Litchfield, we're also self-insured and paying that tax. I support what John and Betsy just presented, and hope that we're able to support moving forward on this. Thank you.
I would just like to add that the Office of Fiscal Analysis has projected that this will save municipalities an estimated $9 million per year, which is a nice savings.
Yes, thank you. And I know one of my towns is self-insured, and I suspect that probably what happens is part of the whole package deal, and they don't look at it as an individual expenditure, so they may not be that aware that the expense is there in their budget, which is probably why, yeah. So I'm sure it will be a savings. For $9 million is nothing to snuff at. So if there are no further questions, we have a motion that was part of the agenda here that we would send a letter of support to the governor concerning this municipal health insurance exemption. Looks like we have a motion that's been moved and seconded. All in favor that we send this letter? Opposed? Seeing none, then the motion passes.
Can I just... Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Also suggest that we direct the same letter to the Finance Committee, because the bill right now is before the Finance Committee. It will be the subject of a public hearing. I don't have a date for that yet.
Yeah, that's probably an excellent suggestion, and maybe we'd send a copy of it to both the Speaker and the President Pro Tem of the Senate. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is an update on our pest management working group. And I tell you, the more I hear about this pest management, the more interested I am in it becomes, because it's one of those things that is not as black and white as it appears on the surface. Representative Nicastro, you're going to give us the report, and to you.
Madam Chair, I would appreciate it if you would give the report, only because, as you well know, I wasn't present this morning. I would have loved to have been present this morning instead of shoveling for 4.5 hours. So I don't know what happened at that, other than taking a quick look at the minutes. So if somebody would prefer to give it that was present at that meeting, I think it would be better.
Okay. Melissa, how would you like to do that? We'll keep you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So we met this morning, myself and Mr. McPherson, and also Richard Calicro, and we kind of looked over the draft that you have, I believe, before you. There's a draft pest control working group report. And those top three issues are ones that we felt that we could all agree to, and we've made some changes this morning in those three issues, specifically as it relates to the second bullet point. We were told of an actual practice that's happening in Massachusetts where they actually have a website that all the towns enter their pertinent data, what applications they've made to their fields or municipal areas, and it's in real time. And the advantage to that is that DEEP would then, if we were to create that sort of clearinghouse, that DEEP would actually be able to go in and review very quickly what's going on, make recommendations, and you know, help possibly prevent misuse or you know, stop a town and before it's, you know, kind of too late. One of the things that keeps coming up that we hear of often and in my towns as well is that the phosphorus level, specifically in some of the organic pesticide applications, are starting to become worrisome. And I can tell you as a member of the Environment Committee, that also relates to issues with invasive species in some of our waterways and algae blooms and other things going on. So we thought that the best practices could have that additional component. It might be worthwhile to look at. As you see, the bottom four, those were issues that we could not come to complete 100% agreement on, although we had some a lot of good discussion regarding that. In addition, we are watching the other pesticide bills that are making its way. We talked about that as well. And we really hope that we can find a way to save our municipalities money. For instance, we learned this morning that in Glastonbury, as an example, has what used to cost them about $4,700 now costs them over $12,000 in application. Also, an additional $40,000 in labor because the pesticides that they're now mandated to use require multiple applications, not just one application. And that happens all year round versus, for instance, a pesticide that they currently cannot use, which would be an application one time in the summer. And so that was an issue. And also, on top of that operating expense on a yearly basis, they've also had to renovate three fields at the cost of over $40,000 just to prep them to be able to start this process. So I'm glad that we're finally taking this up, and I look forward to more discussion on the issue, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative. Yeah, to me it was amazing that even though a lot of this legislation was passed in the name of providing additional safety, that the outcome was that there wasn't actually, it didn't provide that level of safety that the original legislation actually purported that it would provide. And that it's not providing the outcome that the schools need in their athletic fields because many of them are not usable, have needed costly renovations, and upkeep, and they are still not able to get rid of many of the pests such as grubs and other things, and things like poison ivy that are problematic in some of our towns and cities. So it certainly is something that bears additional look at, and so therefore we have some these recommendations. The part about where one application of Roundup would actually do the job, where you'd need multiple applications of an organic type of similar type of thing, and in the end you'd have such a buildup of the even though it was organic, you'd have such a buildup it'd become just as much of a problem. The website that Representative Zebran mentioned, I think, would be very helpful because frequently what happens is, for instance, the gentleman that presented the information to us last time was from Hebron. In Hebron, you have, you know, you have the Salmon River that goes through a number of towns. And you could go online and see what each town along the course of any river or streams that we have in the Connecticut and see what type of field management they were using, because phosphorus, the problem is the accumulative effect. And if one town is using everything reasonably, but the next town is doing the same, along that stream bed, you have an accumulative effect, and we have a better way of assessing that. DEEP has a better way of looking at that and knowing exactly what practices are going on. So it was very interesting. So we're going to get, we will have more information on that system that they're using in Massachusetts. Not saying it's the end-all and be-all, but it certainly sounds very promising and worth us having a second look at. So thank you. Any questions on any of the Representative McPherson, you were there. Do you have any comments you might want to make?
No, I think, Melissa, it's First Selectman. I'm not quite up to your status yet or ever. I think Melissa covered it very well. And, Madam Chair, I will move that this committee add the consensus items from the working group to the report of this subcommittee, as stated.
Okay. Any discussion on that? If not, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? None opposed, and the motion passes. Thank you. And I know, to me, it was very informative. It was a real education, something I don't think about. I mean, grass is just out there, you know, and you don't think about it unless you have a particular problem with grass. And although we have a different kind of grass growing in Connecticut these days, it's more under discussion.
Let's not go there. Two for you, Madam Chair. Two for you.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may, just one question. I apologize for missing that meeting this morning. I had no choice. New York was mentioned. New York was mentioned. You mentioned New York when you were, or somebody mentioned New York, and then I see over here that Connecticut adopts New York, and somebody mentioned Massachusetts. Rather, beg your pardon. Was there a difference between the two, Massachusetts and New York, if I may ask that?
Yes. We, in one of our previous meetings, not today's meetings, we talked about the New York laws with, around pesticide usage, in that it was similar to ours but had some allowances for flexibility. Today, when we talked about Massachusetts. We talked about that in terms of not legislation, but a program that they were using that allowed each municipalities to put online what their current practices were, if they were going to treat fields, what what treatment they were going to provide. It allowed DEEP to would allow them to monitor that so that they would know, allow other towns to know what was happening. And so it was two different states, but two different issues as well. I hope I explained that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. McPherson.
Frank, I think the reference to New York had come up earlier, as was mentioned, and it was because the New York law was a little more forgiving. I believe, allowed some of the administrative folks to decide whether something was usable or not, and I think it was in that context that we were referring to the New York law. My take is that what we've just passed about activating this pesticide advisory council, et cetera, in my uneducated view, that sounds like it takes the place of that.
Right, and I think it would give towns various options and a place to go when they had a problem with any type of pest management, a place to go to get feedback or permission to make those changes, which have been problematic and created some of the problems that we're dealing with right now. Any additional discussion on that issue? And I believe Mr. Paul is going to do a presentation or at least information for us on the notice requirement for the sale or transfer of municipal properties.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've, with your permission, I'm going to ask Mike Ryback, who is our town council, to come up and help me out with this. He's got the legal perspective, and he also provided in your package a copy of potential language changes to Section 7-163E in the back of that package of the statute that we provided. Thank you very much for allowing me to talk about this, but this is something that in Litchfield we had an issue where we were transferring property, and we were following the process that had been in place for years, and that required us to, every meeting we have is a public meeting. We post that public meeting and through our agenda, and we must have had about five or six meetings discussing the potential transfer of a piece of property that the town owned, 12 acres of property, and we were transferring it or selling it for $1 to the Housing Trust in Litchfield for affordable housing. We had applied for a STEEP grant, received the STEEP grant for approval to build this, a couple of the homes on this piece of property. And we followed the process, and in the middle of all of this, the law was changed, and which required at that point to have two postings for a public hearing conducted in a Board of Selectmen meeting. In addition, also post a very conspicuous sign on the piece of property making that announcement, in addition to the normal process where we have our public discussions, we make decisions. And then we have a posting announcing a town meeting to make that decision, and then we have the town meeting, which also acts as a town hearing. So the reason I'm bringing this to everybody's attention is that since we're on the Mandates Committee, I'm looking at this as an unfunded mandate. We've got 101 towns in the state of Connecticut that are selectmen town meeting forms of government. Actually, there are 44 of those towns that have charters, which might eliminate this requirement. I'm not 100% certain. Each community has its own charter, and they apply that charter appropriately for that community. But there are 57 statute towns that do not have charters, and Litchfield is one of them. And those statute towns are now required to expend additional funding for two postings, plus do something that has not traditionally been done in a Board of Selectmen meeting, and that is to hold a town hearing. The only hearing that the Board of Selectmen holds, and it's typically just the first selectman, is if we are applying for a small cities grant, we are required to have a town hearing town hearing for application of the small cities grant, and nobody ever shows up. So that's the only hearing that we ever have, and it's typically just me and the contractor that we're working with to apply for the small cities grant. But traditionally, we have never had to have town hearings at a Board of Selectmen meeting. So it is it's a mandate that requires more steps and could be costly. It causes us to put two more ads in two papers before the town hearing. Then it requires us to put up a very conspicuous sign, which could run, it's got to be at least a pretty sizable sign, at least 8x4 foot, so that people driving by can see the piece of property. Not to mention if there's a piece of property that is landlocked, where do we put the sign? Beyond that, we've got another posting that we have to do for the town meeting, and then we have our normal conducting a town meeting, which all of those steps are costly. So having said that, I was just wanted to bring this to this committee so that we could get maybe the legislature to consider amending the statute so that it may eliminate the requirement for town meeting forms of governments to do that. Because quite frankly, in the town meeting form of government, in the statutory form of town meeting form of government, I can't move one dime from one line item to another line item unless I go through the Board of Finance, which is public meetings. And then if it's $20,000 or more, requires a town meeting. If it's $50 and I make a transfer from one line item to the second. If I have to make a second transfer from that same line item, that requires a town meeting. So in essence, everything that a statutory town meeting form of government does is in public. And this law caused us some consternation because we transferred the property to the housing trust. We didn't follow this law. We had to come back to the legislature, and you legislators, thank you very much, voted to give us voted on a validating act, validating that what we did was appropriate. You slapped our hands saying, gee, we didn't follow the law, but what we did in the transfer was appropriate and valid. So having said that, that's my spiel. I've asked our attorney, Mike Ryback, to come so that he could talk about maybe some of the legal ramifications that might have an impact on our town meeting form of government communities. And as I said, there are 57 of them in the state. So having said that, Mike, thank you.
Yes, my name is Mike Ryback. I live in Harwinton. I represent four towns in Litchfield County, Harwinton, Litchfield, Thomaston. Bethlehem is their town attorney. I used to represent them in the legislature. When I served on the Planning and Development Committee, we did a review of Title VII just to find things like this that were causing mischief for towns. So I appreciate your effort through the unfunded mandates approach to take a look at this. This was passed in 2007 for transparency, it was the terminology, in municipal land transfers. I was told the genesis of it was the Kelo case in New London, but I'm not sure how that alone could have caused all this mischief, because the way the statute is written, it goes much broader than what happened in the Kelo case, where New London transferred property in the Fort Trumbull area that gave rise to that litigation. What it basically says is, in any municipality, even those like Litchfield that have the town meeting form of government, which is pure and open democracy, you have to post two notices, put a sign on the property like you see in a foreclosure, and then have a public hearing in front of the Board of Selectmen before you can then go to the town meeting. Prior to that, you still have to refer it to the Planning Commission under 8-24 to make sure it's consistent with the town plan of development. You have to take it to the Board of Finance to make sure you're not giving away valuable property. You're not going to take property to a town meeting without an appraisal or at least the assessor's word as to how much the property is worth, because that's the first question you're going to be asked at a town meeting. And this can become a trap for the unwary municipality that doesn't see it coming. What I did was I took Section 7163E and I marked it up with tracking as to areas of the statute that I think cause legal mischief. The first is the one that First Selectman Paul referred to, and that is where the form of government, the local form of government, is Board of Selectmen, town meeting. This shouldn't be an issue because we still have to publish legal notice and have what amounts to a public hearing in the form of the town meeting itself where everybody can debate and vote. And if 200 signatures show up 24 hours before the meeting, it'll be a referendum. So in subsection A of the statute, I would recommend exempting towns where the legislative body of the town is a town meeting. For those of you who have representative town meeting form of government, you may want to consider that. Not representing that type of town, I didn't feel I had the liberty to suggest that, but if you have that form of government, you may want to consider this, you may not want to consider. Subsection B is the exceptions to the statute, and the three exceptions that were passed in two acts done in 2007, the second one trumped the first one and expanded the exceptions. First of all, sales of real property, and then you have an exception to the exception, which is always dangerous, parkland, open space, or playgrounds, if the fair market value of the property does not exceed $10,000. I'm assuming what you meant by $10,000 was $10,000 perhaps determined by the Board of Assessors or the assessor in town. I hope it didn't mean you have to go out and get an appraisal, because that's going to cost you $1,000 right there to find out if you can do it or not. The second exception from the statute is common sense, renewals of leases where there's no change in the use of the property. And the third one that was grafted on by the public act that's in your packet is the sale, lease, transfer of real property acquired by the municipality. Now, the statute says from foreclosure, by foreclosure. Foreclosure is a very technical term. It means tax lien foreclosure in Connecticut. Very few towns go through the expense of foreclosing tax liens anymore. They have tax collector deed sales. Those large legal notices you see in the paper basically say, we don't want to go to court and foreclose our tax liens like we want to foreclose a mortgage. And the last thing the town wants to do is end up owning this property. We're going to have a tax collector's deed sale. And if someone bids in, we hold the proceeds for 6 months, an interest-bearing account. If it's claimed, fine, the owner gets it back. He pays the taxes interest. The bidder gets his money back with interest. If it's not claimed, the bidder gets a tax collector's deed. We keep the money. There is a situation that arose, for instance, in the town of Harwinton. A number of parcels went up for sale. Nobody bid. And our first selectman bid in the amount of the taxes to make sure we at least covered what we had outstanding. We got the darn things back. Nobody else trumped us at the auction. So at the end of the day now, the town wants to resell these parcels. Some of these parcels are landlocked. That's why there's no bidder. To put up a 4x4 sign on a property that we have to walk through somebody else's property to get through really doesn't serve public notice. So I added the words judicial or non-judicial foreclosure, meaning sale through tax collector's deed sale where the town gets the property back, or deed in lieu of foreclosure. Many towns hold developments near lakes that had postage stamp parcels that people don't want to pay the taxes on anymore. They'll actually come into the tax collector's office at tax time and say, I just want to give this back to the town. Do you have a quick claim deed form? And the tax collector or town clerk will hand them a quick claim deed form, and you end up with all these postage stamp parcels coming back to the town. They might be worth less than $10,000, but to make it clear that if we wanted to put them back out or to sell them back to the Lake Association, we shouldn't have to go through this public hearing and signposting. And then finally, the fourth one I added, I call the Litchfield exception. If you want to encourage affordable housing in this state, the way to do it is to recycle property the municipality can't use. And that's exactly what happened in Litchfield. 12 acres of land that were given to the town in lieu of taxes in the 1970s by a developer long gone, we wanted to recycle for, it's right on a state highway, we wanted to recycle it for affordable housing. Instead, we got hooked by this statute. And in the end, the neighbors wanted to turn this statute into a referendum on that affordable housing project. And it was the Achilles heel of the project, and thank you for the validating act that solved that. Finally, in subsection C is a new subsection I would suggest. The last thing you want to do is punish the person who gets the property. If the municipality does not comply with subsection A for whatever reason, whoever gets that property has a title defect. They won't be able to mortgage, they won't be able to sell, they won't be able to title insure the property because anyone seeking to overturn the title or question the title, and even the title company, and I had this with Connecticut Attorney's Title Company, say, well, if it wasn't done properly, if it wasn't not noticed, if it wasn't posted, then you don't have good title to the property. You've got to go back through the municipality or get a validating act just for that property to save the title or correct the defect. And the last thing I want to do is punish the person who bought the property. Those are my suggestions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. You know, I sold the town a one-square-foot piece of my property so they could put a traffic signal box on it. I wonder if it had the proper notification.
Well, as long as it's under $10,000, you're all right.
Well, I sold it to him for $1, so I guess I was okay. Yeah, my house is on the corner, and they had a traffic signal box outside of my property, and it's been killed a number of times by cars crashing into it. So they needed to move it in a little bit. So, you know, when I think about that, I mean, there's small little things like that that we do all the time that shouldn't take an act of God to make it happen. Any discussion on this? Representative Nicastro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you very much for an outstanding presentation. You brought back so many memories because we had in Bristol, we had large lots that we were taking by eminent domain and things like that, and unbelievable. And it was, it's nice to hear somebody, you know, that knows what they're talking about. You're very lucky, Leo. Got a good man here.
Yes, we are.
Thank you for a fine presentation.
Well, thank you for listening, and I enjoy coming here every so often.
Any further questions? Anybody else? Any discussion? No. Well, thank you very much. It was certainly very informative. And, you know, as someone who lives in a town with a town meeting and I do understand a lot of what you presented, and it makes a lot of sense.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Do we need to do anything beyond this to have this become an issue with the legislature this session? I mean, I know that Jesse is talking with the speaker, but I was just wondering whether or not we need to send some type of letter or any information to... Would we do that now, or would we wait till the next meeting, or how should we handle this, ma'am?
Madam Chair, I will move that we open the agenda to and add this motion to the agenda.
Okay. And we got a motion on the motion. let me open it for discussion.
My question is just purely, I'm not certain if there's a process that we have. I know we voted on two other ones, and I'm not sure what we should do about this.
Would we move this to the proper committee since we got them meeting now? I would guess real estate committee probably in this case, right?
Planning and development.
Planning and development, so if we move it to that committee, and I mean, for a start, just so we don't miss a deadline.
You know, I'm not 100% sure of how we should proceed with this. I think that there is support going forward for this. It could be part of a larger, more mandates bill or more bill, period, not just with the mandates issues that we have presented, because there will be a bill coming out of all the more subcommittees. As I said, I'm not 100% sure because it's not our usual process how we would proceed.
Could I make, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, could it be possible for us to just write a letter to the Planning and Development Committee and ask them to consider raising this as their bill to get a public hearing on that?
My only suggestion, thank you very much, Representative. My only suggestion is that maybe we have Dave talk to Jesse and see what they would expect. Because I do know that the speaker's aware. I know Jesse has told me that he's talked to the speaker about this since we've been talking about it. So I don't know what the problem. I'm a first selectman. As Fillmore said, we like where we are.
Well, I'm going to make a suggestion. Why don't we put this on the agenda for our next meeting, which is going to be February 28th, and we'll check and find out what process we should fall under and how we should go forward with this. And I suspect that maybe it probably will be go through the speaker, and the speaker will make that decision. It may be part of a larger, more commission bill or not, but I will get that information going forward, come back at our next meeting, and we can put a motion up for that, for whatever the outcome is, if that's agreeable to everybody.
Okay. I'm okay with that. I just wanted to just say one more thing. I would like to thank CCM Bob for carrying the water on this thing. CCM did the work to get this and bring this to everybody's attention, so thanks a lot.
If I could make a suggestion, Madam Chair, as we're, again, winding down the process, and we voted on a few items today, one for a letter of support, one for to add to the consensus items, if we could identify, again, what that process is going to be, will the item that we're sending a letter of support also be included in the consensus items, meaning the insurance premium tax recommendation? I think it would behoove us to have a catch-all list of what we're agreeing to, and it seems like we have some of those items already, low-lying fruit items, which would be useful. I think this item today that we did not vote on, Leo's item, could be one of them. I think legal notices could be one of them, and a few other issues. So for the 28th meeting, I would ask that we have a similar agenda with issue areas that we're planning to vote on and what the vote will mean. It's my understanding that there are vehicles in each committee in the General Assembly that's our placeholders for whatever this group comes up with, and then they get shot out to the different committees of cognizance. So I just urge that as a recommendation.
I believe the exempting municipal health insurance from the state mandated premium tax, because it's part of the governor's budget, which is why we're sending a letter of support rather than what we did with the second, the mandated which is why we're doing it differently. Okay, it's just saying that we are very supportive of what he's doing and sort of a thank you for doing this, that it is important to the towns. If it wasn't part of his budget, we probably would have approached it a little differently, which is why we're doing it that way. Okay. Any additional questions?
Should we provide you with issues we'd like to see voted on at the next meeting?
If you would provide them to David so he can make them part of the agenda, that would be great. Yes.
Sorry, Madam Chair, just a quick question.
Yep.
Shouldn't we be only voting on items that we've had a discussion here about? I mean, it seems that it would be inappropriate to bring out an agenda item to vote on if we haven't discussed it here at one of our meetings prior.
And maybe I made the wrong assumptions. I just assume we've had a lot of discussion on a number of items, and I'm thinking that some of that is part of what you're...
Just wanted to clarify that what we would just be voting on items that we've discussed here.
Yeah, it would not be fair to everybody if it's the first time that they're hearing of it, that they had a...
Thank you.
Although that happens. Any additional words of wisdom? Go ahead.
Can you rephrase that, please, Madam Chair? These may not be very wise, but I do have a question. We are scheduled for the 28th. Was that going to be our last meeting, or do we have another one past that, in your opinion?
I think it could possibly be our last minute meeting, only because of the legislative process. I'll have a better sense of where we are. I think that things are a little bit in a state of flux in terms of meetings, only because of all this snow that we've had has sort of created some a few problems. But because of the timing for the legislative process, it may be our last meeting. If not, it will be our second to the last meeting.
Okay. Thank you. And then one other comment. As we get ready to close down today, I'm sensing I'd like to give some kudos to your staff member, David. When I start getting emails and notices at 9:30 on a Friday evening, I say, okay, this guy's doing his job. So thank you for him.
And I would definitely second that. David has been wonderful. Anything that we need, he's gotten copies of it. He's gotten information out to everybody, and he's really done a wonderful job. So,
Madam Chair, if I can, just to let David know, I apologize. I'm not reading them at 9:30 on Friday night. Although I do appreciate getting them, but...
I just have one more question, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure we're not going to miss any deadlines with some of the things that we're going to present.
I
don't know what they are.
Sometimes it's in the legislature we're able to find vehicles to put amendments on. And so, therefore, there are a number of bills out there that would accommodate our legislation. So I think we're in good shape in terms of deadlines, if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
I think your attorney probably could verify that that's accurate information. Thank you. Representative Nakast.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just, you know, what I've witnessed here in the last couple of months has really impressed me, because we're not just sitting here talking. We're not just sitting here talking and nothing's coming out. I've seen action taking place. I've sat on too many committees through the year where everybody did a lot of talking, and nothing. I'm sure most of us in elected officials have seen that happen. But I'm willing to bet that the Speaker who brought back the Moore Commission, that he'll continue this next year. I'm willing to bet that we'll have this committee being reformed. And keep in mind where our chairlady had to say, because we're in the short session right now. The short session. So we have a cutoff date that's coming up real quick. Okay? Whereas next year is the long session. And it changes. You add 2 months on. Okay? So that's important. I would love to see this committee brought back. Again, when I meet with the Speaker and the Majority Leader, I'm going to recommend, I'm sure I'm not the only one that's going to recommend it, that this committee come back again. Because when you see things being done, it makes you feel like you're accomplishing something, especially when it comes to unfunded mandates. Anybody who's held the office of mayor or first selectman or sat on a city council can understand it, truly understand it. So, and court councils, you know. So, anyway, Madam Chair, I want to thank you. You've done an outstanding job so far, really, truly. I want to thank you.
I've had a lot of help to make everybody look good. All right. If there's no further thing, I
motion to adjourn.